Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. Well, September 11th is right around the corner, and after 19 years of massive surveillance, massive loss of civil liberties, massive loss of life, never-ending war, countless court battles, and one official and many unofficial investigations into the truth about what happened on 9/11, we're still stuck with no truth, no one held accountable, and the most ridiculous outcome of an official investigation into a deadly paradigm-shifting event ever presented to the public. I'm talking about the 9/11 Commission's infamous failure of imagination conclusion to its problematic, and that's putting it diplomatically, investigation into how 9/11 was pulled off under the noses of virtually every government law enforcement and spy agency in the United States. All this smells. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome on the show two extraordinary whistleblowers from two key agencies, the FBI and the National Security Agency, to talk about their personal experiences and compare notes in an examination of that smell factor. Mark Rossini is a veteran of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force who worked internationally investigating terrorist groups. When 9/11 happened, he was the Joint Terrorism Task Force's representative to the CIA's Counterterrorist Center. Rossini was later promoted to supervisory special agent in the FBI's Counterterrorism Division, but remained at the CIA and was selected to start the National Counterterrorism Center. As unit chief of the FBI's Directorate of Intelligence, he produced the President's Terrorist Threat Report and something called the Threat Matrix, on which he briefed CIA Director George Tenet and the CIA's executive leadership on a daily basis. Also on today's show is former National Security Agency senior analyst Kirk Wiebe, who worked at the agency's Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center and was on a team that created a brilliant program called ThinThread. The best parts about ThinThread were that it was cheap, it ensured the privacy rights of Americans, and gathered information in an efficient, targeted way. The program, Wiebe and his colleagues have said, could very well have prevented 9/11, but was killed in favor of a much more expensive, unwieldy, undeveloped program without privacy protections. After 9/11, Wiebe personally witnessed the launch of a new domestic surveillance program called Stellar Wind that collected information on phone calls as well as emails. When Wiebe and his colleagues blew the whistle on the National Security Agency's secret domestic spying program, they were raided by the FBI. Wiebe's family was subjected to a day-long armed raid, with agents rummaging through his family's belongings and taking personal items, some of which have yet to be returned. The bottom line to both Rossini and Wiebe's stories is that 9/11 was prevented from being prevented. That's what we're examining today. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Christina. Appreciate it.
So,
thank you, Christina.
So we'll start with you, Mark.
All right.
Give us a general outline of give us the highlights of your story.
Well, I mean, it's been pretty well publicized, and I've published a 20-something page document on the subject you're talking about as far as the failure of the 9/11 Commission. But the short narrative is that in 1999, I became the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force representative from New York to CIA's ALEC station. And that was to facilitate the flow of information and exchange of ideas, if you will, and mapping, of course, on to combat counterterrorism and to conduct investigations, particularly into the Nairobi and Tanzania bombings. That said, in January 2000, a cable came in from Malaysia, from Kuala Lumpur Station, a CIA cable, came in advising of the, the work that had been done on the surveillance of individuals that were requested to be followed by the Malaysian Special Branch. And it was noted that these two individuals that were there, in particular two terrorists, eventual little bombers, people who flew into our buildings in Pentagon, had visas to come to the U.S. Now, let me give you a broader background on that story. And I'm not a part of it. If I say something, I'm rambling. I'm not, because it's just so much to absorb and try to get straight, because you want to get people, you don't want people to have rumors or false or fake news, as they say, okay? Right. Even though it's 19 years later, you want to get the story correct.
Right.
You see, we had the USS, we had the bombing of course, USS Cole, all right? And that took place in, obviously, in the Gulf of Aden in Yemen. Okay. So in that there was a cell there that was operating in Yemen, that basically there was a phone number that was the Al-Qaeda switchboard, okay? But the NSA and I believe the CIA knew about that number as a result of even the Nairobi bombings. What no one talks about is that the CIA, along with the Kenyan CID, had been investigating and monitoring the Al-Qaeda branch of the Al-Qaeda branch that was operating in and around Nairobi as early as 1996. Remember, Al-Qaeda bombings, according to Ali Mohammed, take at least 2 years to sort out. Ali Mohammed is a captured Al-Qaeda special operations commander, if you will. And so in 1996, they start plotting the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The attacks happened August 7th, 1998, simultaneously. And one of the individuals who was captured, Rashid Dawood Alawali, when he was being interviewed by Special Agent John Antisev immediately after the bombing, John didn't torture him, didn't beat him up, didn't threaten him with bodily harm. He just talked to him like a nice Brooklyn boy would. And he said, "Hey, what did you do that day? Tell me what happened. Talk me through the day." And he talked me through the day as to what happened. And then he said, "Well, did you call anybody?" And he said, "Yeah, I called this number." And that number is the famous number that belongs to the Al-Hada home, the Al-Hada house in Sana'a, Yemen. Who was Al-Hada? Ahmed Al-Hada had pledged bayat to bin Laden years ago. His son-in-law, Khalid al-Midhar, was living with him in his home in Sana'a, Yemen. Immediately, the CIA and the NSA allegedly, or apparently, we do know this, go up on the number. But there's strong reason to believe they have been up on that number since 1996, when the cell was first discovered. It makes sense that the cell, the Kenyans and the CIA were doing the job correctly in Nairobi, as far as back in 1996, they knew about the number. But nonetheless.
You mentioned, by the way, I just want to tell our audience, mentioned Khalid al-Midyar, the son-in-law. He was one of the hijackers.
He was one of the hijackers. He's right, exactly. He's one of the hijackers and the son-in-law of Ahmed al-Hada. Now, so let's just assume that as of August 7th, 1998, or August 10th, a few days after the bombing, that the agency and the NSA were listening to the Hada House number in Sana'a, Yemen, which was, according to Alawali, the Al-Qaeda switchboard, where messages were passed through and through. And we know this because Ahmed al-Hada had pledged bayat to bin Laden, wanted to be a fighter, but bin Laden said, "You're too old to be a fighter, but I need you to help me facilitate messages to the brothers." Okay. We have the phone calls going back and forth. The agency is listening. And from the agency listening is how we learned back in December 99 that Midhar was going to be taking this trip all the way to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Now, he starts his trip at the end of December, beginning of January, and he makes his way through Dubai. And then when he's in Dubai, the agency has Dubai authorities go through his hotel room, go through his luggage, take his passport, photocopy it, and in there they discover that he has a visa to visit the U.S. And then he's allowed to continue on his way and follow all the way, and he gets to Malaysia, and then he's followed, and then, of course, everybody else, the special branch, sees that they're all meeting all these people, and they start photographing and following all them and getting their information. That's how we learned about Nawaz al-Hazmi, the other hijacker that eventually flew with Khalid al-Midhar to the U.S. And the reason why I'm going through all of this is because, pursuant to a phone number being monitored, the agency enlisted the help of several other organizations to track these men halfway around the globe to a meeting and took pictures of it. And now, learned that they had visas to the U.S.
Intelligence agency, not the FBI. We're talking about the Central Intelligence.
Right. We're not talking about the FBI. FBI at this point is not involved.
Right.
Okay? The FBI has even no knowledge this is going on. And these gentlemen, eventually do arrive in the U.S. as of mid-January 2000. But what I'm driving at is that on January 5th, 2000, a cable comes in speaking about this meeting in Malaysia, how these individuals all met, the background, et cetera. And my colleague, Special Agent Doug Miller, who was assigned to the CIA with me, decided that we should send this information, this knowledge, this info that terrorists have visas to come to the U.S., and it should be disseminated to the community, meaning the FBI and the other agencies as far as the State Department, and at that time, Customs and Immigration, okay, as known as ICE.
Right.
And Doug writes his memo, his draft CIR, and of course, your audience doesn't, if they know this, of course, before a document goes out the door, before it's released, it goes through several people who get to chop off on it, and it goes in electronic queue. And you can see where in the electronic queue actually it is. So Doug's memo was held up at this one electronic queue, this one individual. And after a few days, he comes to me, and I guess I was more senior. I had been at Alex Station longer than he. And he said, can you find out why so-and-so was holding up my CIR? And I went, sure. So I went up to the individual, and I said, hey, Doug's memo, it's got to go to the FBI. And that person said to me, no, it's not an FBI case. When and if we want the FBI to know, we will let them know, and you are to stay out of it. The next Al-Qaeda attack is going to happen in Southeast Asia. Any trip to the U.S., and I said, what are you talking about? They have visas to come to the U.S. So any trip to the U.S. is just a diversion. Now, being a good little boy and a soldier.
Ridiculous assumption.
Well, yeah, but you know, playing by the rules, this is why I don't care about the rules anymore. Playing by the rules, and you say, okay, well, it's not my information, it's their information. You're not supposed to poach. And I figured they would do the right thing and tell the FBI
You're there at the Alex Station with them, why would that be poaching information?
Because it's theirs, because we have at that time what we call ORCON, originator control. And the originator gets to control the document, the information. It's their information. It can only be disseminated out of their agency if they want it to be disseminated. Now, of course, organizations like the NCTC kind of have done away with that because everything goes into one central location that everybody can see. But ORCON is still, so to speak, the rule. I would pretty much imagine that it's still in existence today because sometimes an agency has a sensitive, let's say, operation. I mean, on a smaller level, let's say the DEA is doing a major drug trafficking case and they don't want the local sheriff to be disseminated information about what's going on. I get that because there's something maybe bigger, there may be corruption, you never know. So the agency felt that this case was their case. Now, in the grand scheme of things, we know that is total BS. But in reality, this is what the cover-up is. This all goes into what I wrote in my document. This all goes into the problem with the 9/11 Commission and its failure to peel back the onion efficiently to understand why the agency did not want the FBI to know about the meeting in Malaysia and the subsequent, therefore, arrival of the two terrorists when they finally got to the U.S., actually in January 15th, I think they arrived. And that was never disseminated to the FBI on any kind of basis, whether formal or informal. And of course, informal is bullshit because if it's not on paper, it doesn't exist, according to Gopher Black. So it's not on paper. There's no official dissemination of the FBI. And then now begins the cover-up as to why it wasn't disseminated. And I want your audience to understand
But explain, Mark, that it's key.
Yeah, I am.
It's key. No, no, but it's key for the FBI to get this information because the FBI is allowed to operate domestically.
Well, they're not even allowed. It's the FBI's domain. It's the FBI's, FBI's portfolio.
So
okay,
any terrorists coming to the United States, the FBI should know about and should be able to handle.
Do whatever they need to do. Yeah. Whether and any terror, any bad guy, as we say, anybody who's here to do harm or criminality is the FBI's purview.
Right.
So the fact
that they're not given access to these names and told they're coming, you know, you couldn't send that out to the troops in the U.S. to say these guys are coming, keep an eye on them.
Right. And that is the thing that we need to get to the heart of. And this is what I've been killing myself over for the last 19 years to understand why and build a circumstantial case as to try to understand why it wasn't done. And that's why the 9/11 Commission was headed by Philip Zelikow, that apologist who, of course, just whitewashed the whole thing. And I don't care if he's listening, which is fine because he knows how I feel about him and others, and not just me, the 9/11 widows as well. that the commission never actually conducted a proper investigation. You have even Governor Tom Kaine even questioning, you know, we never did get to the reason why that memo wasn't sent. Well, it's very easy to do so. Put people in a grand jury and question them. Actually, one individual who was the deputy chief of ALEC, who was testified behind a curtain, said I still can't believe his testimony. He said, well, we were just so busy, it fell through the cracks. I don't know if I can curse on your show, but are you effing serious? Because that is such a disingenuous statement, because all you have to do, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is study every single cable that went from the CIA to the FBI and vice versa that year, or 30 days before, 30 days after, let's say January 3rd, 2000, and look at the importance of the cable. And I guarantee you, you will not find any cable as important that that would have been. I mean, I know CIRs go out and that just say, just for your information only, you know, we know that so-and-so is meeting so-and-so in a cafe, just so you know. So they, every day, innocuous stuff that you wouldn't think has any meaning is said because everything needs to get shared. And this one thing, the most important thing in the world about two Al-Qaeda terrorists are coming, have visas to come to America.
Two more importantly, future when they, hijackers coming to the U.S.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, two people, or at least one in particular, that you took the time to follow all the way from Yemen. And you're telling me that when you learn that guy has a visa and that he can potentially come to the U.S., that you don't tell the FBI even to put him on a watch list.
So,
and then when he actually gets to America on or about January 15th, 2000, and of course the CIA internally learns in a cable in March that actually took place, you still don't tell the FBI about that either, that they're actually on U.S. soil.
So how high does this go? I mean, whose order was this?
Well, somebody had to make the decision not to tell the Bureau. And now I disagree with a lot of people on this next thing I'm about to say. There are a lot of people that say, oh, the CIA, no, CIA wanted it to happen. Cheney wanted it to happen. Bush wanted it to happen. So they could justify, and they wanted the towers to come down. The Saudis wanted the towers to come down. I don't believe that for a minute. And I'm very sorry if people do, but I think they're crazy. No one wants people to die, okay? What actually happened was that it goes back to a deeper issue about economics and oil and political and religious sensitivities, okay? The agency basically gave the Saudis a free hand to let them report on the activities of these boys through Omar al-Bayoumi, the Saudi operative agent that was living in San Diego, who, of course, befriended them, took them in, and showed them around. The agency essentially gave carte blanche to a foreign intelligence service to operate freely on U.S. soil and report back to them. It was only when the Saudi Mabahith and al-Bayoumi lost contact with al-Midhar, not until June 2001, where the agency said to the FBI, oh, well, we have a problem. You got to find these people. And that was the famous June 2001 meeting. So let me put this in perspective for the audience. You have terrorists arrive in America. Al-Bayoumi, a Saudi agent living in San Diego, takes care of them and monitors them and gives them clothes and an apartment. And then apparently they go on their merry way. And then there's no communication for quite some time. We know al-Midhar, now from historical record, went back to Yemen for the birth of his daughter. And then after that, he went to Afghanistan, lost his passport, went and got a new passport in the Jeddah consulate in Saudi Arabia, in which
consulate where they were handing out the, you know,
visas like candy.
Michael Springman blew the whistle on the fact that these,
right.
And he said, of the 20 people who were there in that consulate, most of them were NSA and CIA people.
Well, I've heard that, yeah.
And that they were basically, whenever he would not want to issue the visa, they would come in and strong arm him and force him to give visas to these people with.
Right. Now, we know that Amidhar's visa, his passport actually had a chip in it from the Saudis that they put in identifying him as a potential threat to the kingdom.
Yeah, the Saudis, this is crazy.
Right.
The Saudis the
Saudis, of course, do not report.
Minds, it's that the Saudis were allowed to have their own operation here.
And well, they were.
And that they were being aided and abetted by the CIA to bring these people in.
Well, we'll turn the blind eye because and I see, this is where you build circumstantial cases, okay? And you put it in front of a jury to decide. And then you, because you have in June 2000, the deputy chief of ALEC, who actually was assigned to the FBI at that time, who very easily could have told the FBI everything was going on all the time that he was assigned there. Why he didn't, beats me. He finally realizes in May.
Why don't you name their names, Mark?
I can't. I'm not allowed to.
Am I allowed to?
You can, but I can't confirm or deny whatever names you use. That's not. I cannot do that because they'll come after me again.
Because
so I don't.
The staff officer who was in charge of tracking her apparently her name was Michael Ann Casey. Okay, she was in charge of tracking Almy Jar, had hand delivered his visa, said that she had hand delivered his visa information to the FBI headquarters, but that's a lie because the logs show she never set foot there. Okay, her supervisor, Alfreda Frances Bukowski, okay, you know, she claims that the information was handed over, and it wasn't.
If it's not on paper, it doesn't exist. And if those two individuals who you mentioned did what they apparently were supposed to have done, it still doesn't constitute passing of information. And if something so important like this, why would you relegate it or delegate it, if you will, to just putting it on like a verbal conversation or a piece of paper that you're handing over? Why don't you make it part of the official record and send it in the CIR?
Okay.
It's a total cop out and a lie. It's bullshit. Okay. The total cop out and a lie.
Meanwhile, at the NSA, Kirk.
Sorry, I went on so long.
No, it's fine. Kirk, at the NSA, what's going on at your place? What are you experiencing?
This is hard for me to say because I put myself in the position of an analyst who has become aware of information of the utmost importance to national security. And I discover that 9/11 is going to happen. And I write a report, and I go to send it out of the building, and it stopped by none other than Michael V. Hayden, U.S. Air Force Major General, Lieutenant General, retired. And you have to understand that Bill Binney and I and the others that blew the whistle on NSA were out of the building already when we discovered that. We left right after 9/11. October 31st of that year, in disgust, because 9/11 should never have happened, even without the knowledge that there was some pocket of analysts who had the data already and knew what was going to happen. The idea that a general rank officer, director of a major agency, can stop what we call indications and warning information from being disseminated to the right people with the intelligence community and the White House is just unfathomable. And this kind of gets to Mark's point. Why in the world would anyone try to squelch knowledge about this in any respect? And I don't have a clean answer to that, but I've been told a logical one is because the Bush administration and the whole Bush family had close ties with the Saudis. And they didn't want this to embarrass the relationship. Or it could even cause severed ties. Who knows?
Well, you know, just Kurt, you hit on the point there. And I think everything came clear to me when I was watching a documentary that I had appeared in by the French author and filmmaker Fabrizio Calvi. It's in English. It's called La Route de Terror, The Roots of Terror. And when the light bulb went off for me when I was watching the documentary and Fabrizio interviews Bruce Rydell, who was a former CIA official now at the Brookings Institution. And Steve's interview hit it. Steve said, we had a tacit policy with the Saudis that if we found their wayward sons around the globe, we would gently guide them back to the kingdom for reprogramming or readmission into society to change their evil ways. And when I heard that, that's when it struck me. That's when everything came together as far as the fact that, you mentioned it, Saudi sensitivities, the embarrassment to the kingdom. Remember, oil drives the machine of the world, and he who controls the oil controls the world. And of course, the oil is also sold in what we call petrodollars. It's not pegged to the euro or the ruble or the Chinese renminbi, okay? It's pegged in dollars. And we will do anything and everything to protect that dollar barrel figure and that relationship with the Saudis for access to light sweet crude, our military bases in the Middle East, and the safety and sovereignty and protection of Israel. It all plays together for the big global picture. And nothing was going to embarrass that by having it form. Now, this is where people will say, oh, you're just so personal. But my opinion is the CIA, Alex Station, did not want the FBI in the form of Big Bad John O'Neill, my boss, who perished in the World Trade Center, to take over the case in the USA, not be controllable, and that he would arrest Amit Harahazmi and others as he found fit to do along the way, and then embarrass the kingdom. So it was a plan, a plot, if you will, on the part of people at Alex Station and people higher up, perhaps, to say, all right, let the Saudis do their thing, they'll report back to us. And of course, when the Saudis failed to do that, when they finally came with the hat in their hand, probably in May 2001, and said, we lost Amit Har. We have no idea where he is. Al-Bayoum is no longer following him. We have no more connection. That is when Alex Station went running up to FBI New York in June 2001 and said, help us find these guys, and showed Steve Bongard and Russ Fincher, two agents on my squad, pictures of Al-Hazmi and Mihdhar, and said, we need you to find them. And Steve said, well, where'd you get the pictures from? Who are they? We can't tell you that. What do you mean you can't tell me that? You asked me to find somebody. You give me the guy's name. But you won't tell me how and why you took the photos and why I need to find them. No, we can't tell you that. So up until that moment, when they actually asked the FBI for help in person, they still would not tell them the circumstances surrounding how they took the photographs. And by the way, it was a meeting I was not invited to.
Well, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something, Kirk. What do you attribute Hayden's behavior, his action? To what do you attribute that?
I think Hayden, once he got this intel at his desk, and I'm sure it was something that sensitive, it got to his desk rapidly. And he probably felt an obligation to call the White House and to personally deliver the message. And somewhere in that chain, whether it's Cheney, Bush, I don't know, Gonzalez, don't know, National Security Advisor, but in any case, he gets told, do not report it. Somebody in that Bush administration gave orders not to report.
Well, I mean, who would Hayden have gone to, in your mind?
Probably Cheney.
To Cheney. I mean, the other thing, by the way, Mark, that you mentioned in your report, that I almost fell off my chair when I read this. Okay.
Okay.
You said that CIA wasn't sharing this information with the FBI. Because the CIA was engaged in a recruitment and surveillance operation in the U.S. along with Saudi Arabian intelligence services.
I stand by everything. I stand by everything that I wrote, because remember when also I go back to Richard Clark being interviewed, and Richard Clark says that when he congratulated Kofor Black on becoming the director of CTC, okay, Kofor said to him, well, Richard said, you know, how you doing? What's going on? Congratulations. He goes, yeah, you know, I'm really excited. And one thing I need to change is that we do not have any sources in Al-Qaeda. And I'm determined to change that. So this presented a perfect opportunity for people that were arriving in the USA that they could possibly try to target and recruit and learn about. And that was, I believe, what was going on. Let Omar Al-Bayoumi develop a relationship and then perhaps introduce an American personnel or let the Saudis themselves recruit him to find out what's going on. And of course, that failed, and that never took place.
So,
and that's what and Al-Mihdhar was targeted specifically because he just had a baby. He had a wife and child, so he had something more to live for, whereas the others really had nobody.
So,
and that was hope.
I'm going to go back to Kirk for a minute because, okay, so the NSA had content of phone calls between American Airlines 77 hijacker Al-Mihdhar in San Diego and the Al-Qaeda, the calls between San Diego and the Al-Qaeda safe house switchboard in Yemen before 9/11. So they knew all about the inbound and outbound hijack. Now, talk about, I want to move a little bit to the cover-up now, because you have Cheney saying to the press that there was no info on these on the two San Diego terrorists before 9/11.
He's a total liar.
He's a liar. Yeah.
And then you have, but you also have the FBI's director, Mueller, who testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee saying, we could not know who was calling that particular safe house in Yemen.
And I want to stop you there, because I want you to imagine if a phone company knows that a phone calls another phone for billing purposes and is right 99.99% of the time, are you telling me the entire intelligence community, the United States government, couldn't figure out who belonged to what number?
Right. And AT&T controls all the billing around the globe anyways. They clearly,
are these two people lying?
To cover up what Mark is talking about.
Why is your guy, FBI Mueller, lying? Why is he lying?
Well, I have to review Director Mueller's testimony, and unfortunately, it's very hard for one FBI agent to say anything bad about a director. I know people are going to be mad at me about that one. But I need to understand Mueller's full testimony in order, because I don't see how Director Mueller would have any reason, so to speak, to lie about that. Or maybe he was, I don't know. I can't understand why he could say something like that, because, or maybe he just wasn't given the right information. But
How can he not have the right information?
You're right. All right information before he testified is what I'm driving at. I don't know. I don't know the circumstances, but and again,
at the very least, say I don't know. Don't cover for this guy.
Well, at the very least, you're right. Say, but the fact of the matter is that the information was known about them. Okay, as far as the FBI is concerned, the FBI had no information about them whatsoever before the 9/11 attacks, with the exception of being asked to go find them. Actually, that the find them lead did not actually come out until August 21. 2001, when the actual cable actually got to FBI New York on a routine basis to find them.
Now, let me ask you something. Could the FBI not have gone directly to the NSA?
Oh, perhaps. Of course they can. Of course the NSA, the FBI does that all the time. The FBI works directly with the NSA.
Well, what happened in this case?
That I do not know. That I do not know. But,
I mean, if the CIA isn't going to give you the information, go to the NSA, because the CIA is getting their information from the NSA.
Yeah, well, exactly correct. And I don't think the Bureau probably knew that that was going on, because the Bureau had no idea what was going on in Malaysia. The Bureau had no idea what was going on with the Saudi Mawahid. They had no clue.
But once they were told to look for these guys, why, and they weren't being given any information by the CIA, why didn't they turn to the NSA?
Well, the FBI in that meeting was not told by the CIA personnel where they got the information from. And the Bureau just on its own, talking to two street agents on my squad, I don't know what their thinking was, but I don't fault Stephen Rush for not going to the CIA and say, what do you know about these guys? Because they didn't have their names, really. They didn't have anything to go on. It wasn't until August 2001 when a formal cable actually came from the agency to the FBI, requesting the FBI to find them.
Something isn't right here. I mean, because it just seems to me...
Well, the FBI doesn't automatically go to the NSA on every single thing. It doesn't automatically say, well, the NSA is not telling us something. We'll go there. No.
this is something of such desperate import, really. I mean,
well, now we know it's desperate.
No, import. But your guy, no, but your guy who wanted, who wrote up the memo and was, and you know, Douglas, right?
Yeah.
He wrote that memo, and he was freaked out that you weren't allowed to share it. And then next thing you know, they come to CIA, comes to you. You know this memo exists. That later on, they come to you and they say, okay, look for these two guys. You know who those two guys are. You saw him, their names in the memo, right? So
right.
CIA doesn't give you the information. Go to the NSA. I mean, to me, I hear these two stories, and what I hear is some kind of high-level kibosh, multi-agency.
Well, I don't see it at that point in time, as far as when the lead finally came to the bureau, because it was, you know, it came in the dog days of August, okay, and it was marked routine, find these two guys. Now, the lead goes out, you do routine work, you have 30 days to return the lead to headquarters on a routine basis, okay, to find them. And the lead was, apparently, one of them put down, staying at Marriott Hotel in New York. You know how many Marriotts are in New York? So you as an agent have to go around to every single Marriott, knock on the door, go in, say, hey, you know, I don't have a subpoena. Then you got to, well, then they're going to say, well, I want a subpoena. Well, then you got to go to an AUSA and get a subpoena and go back.
So that's like in the weeds investigation.
Well, no. But what I'm driving at, in the weeds affects what happens. You don't automatically go to the NSA and say, what do you got on these guys? No, because it's routine. This is the whole thing, and it's coming, and there's no further information.
It just seems like once you guys were aware, even though you were being suppressed by the CIA at that point, at a high level, you were being
And then
they come to you later. I mean, look, I'm not trying to beat up on you, you know, because
I probably
beat up on yourself enough with this, but there's something, it's just like what happened, what Kirk was saying. You know, this report, Kirk, can you give us general information about the contents of this report? I mean, what can you say about this report that makes you say this report would have prevented 9/11?
Well, it's and I'm going completely on Tom Drake's words, what he told me, because Drake was still at NSA at this point. Bill and I had checked out and thrown our badges on the table and said, we've had enough of this horse bunky. But Drake was still there. And so he has, if there's any detail beyond what I've said, Drake would have it. Drake was also interviewed by the 9/11 Commission and has the same opinion of it that Mark does, that he told them things like I'm telling you, and none of it appeared in the written report they put out. It was all whitewashed.
This is the thing. This is the thing that I find, I can't swallow it. It's stuck in my throat, okay? Everybody keeps saying things like, well, you know, Hayden has never been held accountable for what he did. Tenet, I don't care what you say, Tenet was in this mix. He had to have been in this mix. Okay. So so now you have the FBI, you have the NSA, you have the CIA, the three top spy agencies. You know, well, FBI is more law enforcement, but they do all the spying.
Big part.
Spying is part of law enforcement.
Espionage, sure.
You've got three of these agencies backing off and then being told not to, you know, share, whatever. It's almost like you were being compartmentalized in some way, too.
Well,
I'm so suspicious that I can't even tell, but I can't put my finger on the whole picture.
Well, because no one's testified truthfully as to who knew what, when, where, how, and why.
That's exactly right. That's right. I mean, and I have to tell you something, and Mark may also have heard this. Even at that point in time, we're talking 9/11, 2001, the agencies were, it's like you just said, Christina, the compartmentalization shows up in the form of arrogance and mm-hmm. desire to control the discussion. In other words, did NSA freely give information to CIA? I'm going to guarantee you it didn't.
Well, it didn't because, even though I think he's a little... He's a little office rocker. But even Mike Scheuer in the documentary, The Shadow Factory, The Spy Factory by James Bedford, he says the CIA, the NSA wouldn't give them their half of the take on the Hodder House. They had to put up their own. They had to put up their own listening post in order to get the full conversation.
Yeah.
So why was that? Why was that being withheld by the NSA, even to the CIA itself? And of course, you have George at the time was the DCI. So in effect, over the NSA. Essentially, correct?
Yeah.
So why wasn't that Saudi Arabia? It's sacrosanct. There's something that has to be, oh boy, we gotta stop. We gotta think about this now because it involves them. It involves oil. It involves the economy. It involves our presence in the Middle East. It involves the big chessboard of what's going on. And do not dare embarrass them.
It's the great game for oil. It's been going on for over a century. And here's the thing. The thing is that you guys are saying the United States of all Americans in this country have to accept that the people who were responsible, for the 3,000 deaths, for the biggest terrorist attack ever on this soil, for the resulting wars, the resulting, curbing of civil liberties and everything else, we have to all let go and concede to the very people who did this to us.
That's right.
Well, you have a point. Yes, you have a point. You have a point. You have a point. You know, again, no one in the Saudi government wanted this to happen. No, the king and the princes and everything did not want this to happen.
I don't know about that. I really don't know about that.
It doesn't serve their purpose. They're more concerned about getting into heaven and being pious and protecting the two holy places than they are about anything else. And it all comes down to the embarrassment and the legitimacy as the leaders of Islam and the planet. Okay, that's what it really comes down to. That's more important than any oil could ever imagine.
I think we play it both ways because I remember very well, when the press was talking about how bin Laden, first of all, the Bush family was doing business with the bin Laden family. Osama was becoming Osama was our guy. He was the CIA's guy in Afghanistan.
Yep.
Okay.
Apparently,
and all of a sudden he's called a black sheep. All of a sudden there's a story about him being a black sheep. And I thought to myself that, because I'm from Haiti, okay? Mm-hmm. I know how these ruling families behave, and it's not even about ruling families understand other ruling families. Everybody else is a cockroach for their purposes, for whatever it is that they need to do. And I remember reading a book written by Salem bin Laden's ex-wife, who this very sophisticated woman from Geneva who had to flee with her daughter when she realized, oh my God, my daughter's going to become, whatever. Super religious. Anyway, while bin Laden was off doing all his terrorist things, even after 9/11, allegedly, his kids, first of all, he was not, nobody was speaking ill of him or anything in the family. His kids were and wives were being looked after. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was no blackballing of Osama bin Laden. So all these narratives, still cannot contain the fact that if so many of them came from Saudi Arabia, so many of them were given visas by the intelligence services because, you either had to do that or, as Springman said, you get Freeman was retaliated against in the end when he blew the whistle. Okay. So this, and nobody's held accountable.
No.
What?
Because as you and I spoke about, it's like a casino. It's a house. The house always wins. Okay. And when you mess with the house, you lose. And if you disturb the house from keeping its winnings, then you're out the door.
Just tell me who the house is.
Well, the house is the U.S. government. The house really is the U.S. government and all of us.
It is not the U.S. government because you were part of the U.S. government.
Right.
You were part of the house. So
yeah,
the house is not just the U.S. It's not the U.S. It's certain factions. It's certain people in the U.S. government, maybe.
Yes, and they have deemed themselves as protectors of the house. And we are all part of the house because we enjoy every day getting up and getting into our car and getting cheap gas and driving around and having all the luxuries that we have in the USA because of this cheap flow of oil and this access to it. And that's the bigger, grander picture on the bigger, bigger scale. That's actually more important than 3,000 people dying, according to these individuals, okay? Because, oh, well, yes, it happened, but we still have our presence in the Middle East, and it's the greater good that will come out of it. I know, this is sickening to even discuss, talk like that, but that's how the thinking goes sometimes, okay? And unfortunately, and again, this is post-thinking, of course, because no one wanted that to happen at all. But the original reason why Doug's memo was not passed, and I have written this, that even if Doug and I weren't alive, we were never born, we were never assigned to the CIA, they had an obligation to pass that to the FBI. We have to get to the reason as to why that wasn't done. That moment in history is everything. Everything else that comes after it is irrelevant. Not irrelevant.
Well,
I'm driving at that. That's the key. That's the key. January 5th, 2000, when Doug wrote his draft CIR, the fact that when the deputy chief Alex Station messaged back an individual, the individual that I spoke to, said, hold off for now. We have to get from him why he wrote that individual, hold off for now. What was so important to hold off or not send
to
the FBI?
I have to say something, Mark. I have
Please.
To say, after 9/11, you have to say qui bono. Okay?
Okay, qui bono, exactly correct. Who benefits?
Who benefits? The oil companies benefit, the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds and all those guys benefit, you know? And we are sitting here in a smaller and smaller national security state box. Kirk, I want you to weigh in on this. I don't want
Please.
To be the only one arguing here, but I just, I find this whole conversation so outrageous that...
it's disturbing.
Go ahead.
Well, let me say that I agree. It's mind-blowing. That something that 3,000 people could be sacrificed for what? A dollar? What?
Wait a second. Why are we only talking about 3,000 people? We're talking about 3,000 people in the beginning, and then we got all the people who came after that, who the wars that are based on the rationale of 9/11. Okay,
that's right.
All the people who have died, civilians, our own troops, the troops of other nations, whatever, this whole endless war, et cetera. I mean, come on, let's not just limit it to 3,000 people.
No,
not at all.
Just,
it's reparations, right.
And that's the whole thing is, I mean, 9/11 is the crime that keeps on giving.
Yeah, and it's the whole surveillance state. Look what's happened to surveillance.
It's a failure of imagination.
Right. And look at the surveillance state that we've become. And it's not just the government anymore. You have cartels spying, intercepting, tapping into the internet. You know, everybody thinks only the government knows technology. My God, it's ubiquitous. And it's everywhere. And I could tell you a couple other things about clandestine collection, non-authorized collection of data going on in
Let's
the country.
Hear it. Let's hear
you know,
it.
Yeah, and so it's out of control. Those in control of our government are out of control.
Well,
in allowing this to happen. Do you know there's a simple solution to mass surveillance and to get in line with the Constitution?
What is it?
Please.
Bill Binney, when they first operated Thin Thread as a research prototype, made sure that any data that was coming from a U.S. domain. Domain means, for example, there's a set of servers on the internet that are U.S. And the international authorities that organize this have it all laid out. If you're from this country, that country, that country, the numbers that address those servers are cataloged, okay? And that's what makes the system work. There's order. It's not chaos. And the same is true of the phone system. Everybody has blocked out phone numbers, so it's easy to trace numbers to a point in a country, at least a city, down to that level. And so Binney encrypted anything coming in that was U.S., and it couldn't be looked at by an analyst unless within 30 days, someone said there's a tie-in between a foreign party and a U.S. citizen involved in crime. Then NSA had the authorization to uncover the identity of the other number.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yeah, yep. And so
that would have taken care of the mass surveillance problem.
Well, sure, because if you've got good encryption and it keeps it away from analysts, and you're operating within the spirit of the Constitution and probable cause, you really don't have a problem. But everybody, all the leadership agencies in the community demanded open access to this data.
Yeah.
And when you do that, the probability of a Trump administration being spied, I mean, that's exactly what we warned about 20 years ago. If you unleash this data, it will be misused at some point. Guaranteed.
I mean, it sounds like this is crazy. It sounds like we're living in an Orwellian state now.
We are.
Wow.
And so, what is the solution?
What do we do? Yeah.
The courts? Do we go to the courts about this and how it was developed? And you know, all this was developed on the back of 9/11. I mean,
that's right.
You know, all of
this. Are you talking about Stellar Wind? Is that what you are getting at, or no?
What?
Are you getting to about Stellar Wind? Is that what you're talking about, or no, or getting to the program Stellar Wind?
Well, I mean, are you talking to me or to Kurt?
Yeah, but both of you. I mean, I don't. Well,
Stellar Wind is just another iteration of the technology in general, targeted to get to the internet and be able to extract data that you want to be able to extract. So those are just technologies in different stages. FinThread was one. It was an early prototype. Then it went to Stellar Wind. And then Hayden tried to do even better under Trailblazer and failed completely. But the point of it is, I don't have a problem with agencies, Intel agencies, trying to understand technologies to see how they can leverage. There's nothing the matter with that. What's the matter is who you're targeting and what are you doing with that data? Is the Constitution in some respect guiding you, or is it, hey, it's a free-for-all. Let's see what we can do. Now, we've spoiled the hell out of the FBI, who used to have to do good old-fashioned gumshoe investigations. Now they just want to open up a database and look at stuff and find, oh, that's interesting. Let's go investigate this guy. The DEA has an organization, Special Operations Division, SOD, where they use SIGINT data, NSA data, to open up investigations. And they go after people in court, and the defendant is never told that the first inkling, the first hints, were from SIGINT. They don't tell the judge. They don't tell anybody.
That's where the lead came from, though, you're saying, right?
That's right.
It's a startup. Okay.
Yep, that's right.
Right.
And
right.
So,
well, that's...
yeah.
Well,
so that's what we're living under.
So
right. totally electronic world. Now, of course, the pushback to that one, though, if we could have, obviously, is that, well, look, a lead is a lead. It's the same thing. I'll be the devil's advocate here. It's the same thing as an anonymous source calling up and saying, look, I know tonight at 8 o'clock on the docks is going to be a shipment of cocaine. Hang up the phone. Well, it's a lead and you pursue it. And it turns out that it happens. So in some ways, the court and the law looks at it. Well, look, the NSA gathers this information the way it gathers it. It just provides the lead and says, look, you may want to check this out. And then, of course, from there, evidence is mounted that can be used in the court of law. But just like the government doesn't, let's say, give up its anonymous tipper, well, because the government actually can't because a person calls in a tip and it turns out to be true, well, it's the same way. It affords the same protection. But the crimes still happen. The drug trafficking still happen. Well, that's the counter argument to what you're saying. But, of course, I understand what you're saying, that we live in such an electronic world that we have no privacy anymore. And the fear is that your private life and things you do will be turned against you. Let's say whoever gets some power doesn't like you, can use the fact that you do certain things harm you, and they're not even criminal, or help prevent you from getting a job, or just spying on you. And we live in a dystopian world where every action you do is recorded, and then you're judged on some sort of scale. For, let's say your credit, you can't even open a bank account because the system, the algorithm will show you're no good. I get it. I that's the fear where we're going.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, and I'll tell you, I don't fear it, but I feel that that is worse than terrorism, being attacked by a terrorist.
Well, it is.
I mean, you know, I know that sounds controversial.
No,
this is your day-to-day living where, you know, you are living in a glass box. And whatever it is that you generate in terms of data or information can be used and weaponized against you.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's its own form of terrorism, frankly. It's its own form of terrorism.
It is,
you know.
So, yeah. I mean, I think those of us who are willing to speak up and speak out about this and what happened and trying to get to the truth, I appreciate very much both of you gentlemen for serving your country and for unfortunately having to stand up and you know, I mean, I know you love your agencies and this corruption, and it's you know, it's heartbreaking, but you know, you did what had to be done, and I think I appreciate it, and I hope you keep doing it.
Well, so sure will. Keep up the good fight.
We're out of time.
Okay.
So thanks so much for being on the show. And,
thank you.
I don't know. Maybe we should continue this conversation in a year or so and see if we've gotten any further.
Anytime.
Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Christina.
Bye.
Christina.